For the next hour, we'll be speaking with Taylor Barcroft about the future of media and the new Apple video-supported iPod.
Geek Speaks podcast and website are brought to you by GNI, a full-featured web hosting facility that provides co-location services and high-bandwidth connectivity. More information about GNI is available at www.gnihosting.com.
It's Friday, October 28, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, on Geek Speak, after Spot of Geek News, we're going to be talking all about new avenues for media, highlighting the new video-supported iPod from Apple. But looking at the self-designed media that's coming out from podcasts, video podcasts. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Geek Sean Cleveland, Senior PR Marketing Manager for NetCell. We also have our guest, Taylor Barcroft. And Tyler, you're welcome to join us if you like in this news segment. Sean, because you're the only official geek in the room, besides myself, I'm going to start with you today on the geek news.
Hi, Lyle.
Would you rather I do it? You just walked in. You know, I know you're getting a little baby at home, and you're not ready. It's okay. Let me talk about something I heard this morning on Democracy Now! About Passport RFID. This is a radio frequency ID thing that gets inserted into passports. The Fed recently suggested it, thought about it, and then they're possibly rethinking it. So in general, RFID tags are small pieces of metal that give off an ID number, and that's all it is. That's why it's called RFID. So it's a unique number generated by a little piece of metal. And the thing that got me on Democracy Now! Was that the mentioning was that all this private information would be sending on this piece of metal. In reality, it's just a number, and then you would do a lookup on that information. So I just wanted to clarify that it's not that your picture and your home location and your parents' birth and all that information is going to be broadcast, but more that a number that you could then look up that information would be broadcast. And I guess it would be making checking out and checking passports easier through different terminals and such. That's my quick thought on it, researched very quickly before I got on air today. But that's just a little bit calming down on that notion of private information. The other thing that are you ready now, Sean?
Yeah. So okay. Honda announced their next generation fuel concept car, the FCX, and with it they announced a hydrogen generation filling station. That's all you need, right?
I guess.
So before you start putting the solar panels in your house, maybe you might want to consider putting a little hydrogen reactor. That's not a
right,
reactor.
Generator, right?
So, that'd be fun to say. So these cars, these new generation, next generation concept cars, can currently drive about 350 miles using two separate 350 PSI hydrogen storage tanks. Kind of interesting that maybe you won't be taking your car to a filling station for hydrogen, you'd be doing it at home. Supposedly, this filling station uses natural gas to produce electricity, heat, and hydrogen, and can reduce the total running cost of household, by about 50%.
Wow.
So they're low-floor design Honda, because the way these next-generation cars work, you don't need, the engines don't take up the space that they used to.
Really?
And you don't have all these things underneath the car like you did. So you'd actually have lots of room. It'd be like sitting in a room.
Huh.
These cars, supposedly. Lots of floor space.
Minivans for everybody.
So they're calling them low-floor design. Uses vertical gas flow, vertebral layout, and volume-efficient packaging. So
for the
lots of
engine.
New technologies going into these cars. I'm sure they look different on the outside, too.
Year, when do they come out?
You know, I would expect this is 5 to 10 years down the road.
Oh, perfect.
good. That's maybe we'll have money for that at that point. Okay, I'll take one. Yesterday, my wife mentioned to me that MIT fired a professor that was falsifying data. And the biology professor, and Luc Van Paris, and basically he's associate professor of biology, and he's been not able to go into his laboratory since August because of this colleague said, you're falsifying data. And he was falsifying data in, I guess, biological experiments. But the hammer that MIT laid down is pretty strong, and I really appreciate that. It's one of those things where it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, when someone does science poorly in a institution that is a science institution, if you will, they're disqualified. And this is a pretty serious way to be disqualified, to lose your position, to get kicked out of the university. So that's kind of interesting, support for science, if you will.
Speaking of science, scientists have been hard at work producing the world's smallest car.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
What's the car?
Well, they all fit inside a single molecule.
You weren't kidding about smallest car.
It has a chassis, axle, and pivoting suspension. The wheels are buckyballs, which are spheres of pure carbon containing 60 atoms apiece.
So the wheels are 60 atoms.
The whole car is no more than 4 nanometers across. Just so you get an idea, human hair is about 80,000 nanometers thick.
Right, so this vehicle could get lost on a hair.
You wouldn't see it.
Yeah. Well, of course.
Probably need like a microscope.
Does it actually rotate? Does it move?
Oh, yeah. It totally moves. It's really kind of interesting. They're at room temperature, strong electrical bonds hold the buckyball wheels tightly against a gold plate. And then heating it to about 200 degrees Celsius frees them to roll. So this car actually rolls and has free-moving suspension.
When it's really hot.
Yeah.
Huh.
They had to use scanning, tunneling, microscopy to see the thing, to prove that it rolls like a car.
This is fascinating. I mean, this is the nanotechnology we've been talking about for coming up for years. So they have a functional structure that moves around. That's
and they,
a new
they've,
thing.
They've made motors, mm-hmm. robots, refrigerators, and fountain pens now. So what will they be used for? Well, I don't know. I'm sure somebody will figure it out.
They're advancing the technology of nanotechnology, and who knows what we'll be using it for in the future. Well, thank you very much, Sean, for joining me in the news segment today. I think, unless you have something else pressing that you'd like to cover before we take off. Barkoff?
Well, Apple announced dual-core processor G5s last week.
That's a valid news story, yes.
Yeah, there's a single dual-core 2.0 gigahertz and single dual core 2.3 gigahertz, and then dual core, in other words, 4 processors at 2.5 gigahertz.
This must be the Intel designs?
No,
these are still PowerPC.
That's funny because, you know, Apple really announced, recently, 3 months ago or something like that we're going to say goodbye to the PowerPC chip and go over to the Intel line, and Apple is going to move all that stuff over, and we're talking about a year phase before we see the release of those.
And the Power Mac, it won't be till 2007.
On the Power Mac. Oh, really? Because the heat distribution on the Power Mac is not as severe as laptops.
Well, these dual core are probably going to help with the heat a lot.
I'm surprised to see such a fundamental change like dual core hit the PowerPC market functionally.
Well, it's not that fundamental. I mean, the dual core processor has been announced a year ago.
Okay, they've been working on it for a while.
So, if anything, we expected it sooner than this.
Mm-hmm.
But each processor has 1 megabyte of level 2 cache, which is twice as much as before.
Yeah.
And the RAM is running at 533 megahertz instead of
533 megahertz
instead of 400 megahertz.
That's good.
Wow, that's great.
Well, so Sean, how does that compare with like AMD and Intel on their dual cores? Is that front side bus about the same speed?
No,
that's not the front side bus. That's the
speed.
RAM speed.
Okay.
533. The front side bus is still 50% of the.
Of the RAM speed?
Of the processor speed.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's considerably faster. It's like in video rendering, it's like 60% faster than the dual 2.7.
And you're saying that the Intel stuff won't hit the PowerPC market for at least 2007. So
the potentially Power Mac. Yeah.
Power Mac. So if you're getting a Power Mac, G5 is what we call them right now still.
Right.
You might want to get them now unless you're planning on waiting until after 2007. The thing I question is, will a Intel-based laptop surpass a G5, even dual core, when they release them next year? Because of the increases in speed we're going to see from Intel. But maybe not.
No,
maybe they're
they're only going to be dual core in the PowerBook. There's not going to be four processors.
Right.
So you have four processors in the top of the line.
Sure. The top of the line would make sense.
Which is $3,300 with only a half a gig of RAM.
Sure.
Can the Mac OS take advantage?
RAM,
oh, really?
By the time you add the RAM, it's over $4,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what did you ask?
Can the OS take advantage of the is it multi-threaded?
Yeah, the OS 10 is inherently multiprocessor, so right away you get a boost in performance.
What's interesting, the difference between multiprocessor and dual core from an operating perspective is actually it's different. So I'm wondering how they support dual core as well.
If there's four processors, it's going to be an increase in performance over six.
Yeah, Microsoft has been, they've been dragged across the coals this past week.
So?
They had a show, I don't remember what it's called, it's a Microsoft show,
mm-hmm.
and they invited a bunch of software engineers to come and talk about next generation technologies. And what people have learned is, the first generation Xbox 360, the games aren't that great, and they're not going to take advantage of the power, but they also learned that Windows is not multi-threaded enough to
handle dual core and multi-processor.
Yeah, you're buying these processors, you're not really getting a lot for them.
You mean even with Vista?
Well,
Vista's like 2 years out, right?
Yeah, they're just talking
Vista's
about
being the new operating system.
They're talking about current
Vista's
operating system.
Spring.
That's what they've been saying for a while. But yeah, I mean, I was kind of joking about its duration of when we see
they're
it.
They're really tied down by applications. I don't think you can really get a lot of performance benefits just from the operating system.
Right.
It really needs to be the applications have to be written, and the tools aren't there.
Yeah.
And that's the big problem right now.
The development tools aren't there.
The development tools aren't there for multi-threaded applications.
Of course, they probably are on the Mac at this point.
Yeah, on the Mac side, it's going to be a transparent transition.
Right. Well, you still got Adobe, you know.
Yeah, that's what's going on right now. I heard recently that Adobe has been looking at the numbers on Intel versus AMD dual cores and how Photoshop, basically that's what we're talking about from Adobe, is doing in that realm.
Yeah.
And it's not a lot of public talk about it, but it's difficult to get numbers that are correct. It's difficult to get it to function better when you'd expect it to get better, a dual core, processor should be
better.
None
of this stuff is really out there in the public. I mean, it's available, but the prices points are keeping it from the general public.
Right.
So I think it's going to take some time, a couple of years before I think it really matters to most people.
That's a long, long time out. All right. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Sean Cleveland and also Taylor Barcroft. Some estimates say that 15,000 audio podcasts exist today, including around 1,000 video podcasts. These are people producing their own content normally and putting it online in a form that is easy to download multiple times. So you can kind of subscribe to a podcast. You can think of them as channels, kind of. And they download to your computer and possibly to your portable device like an iPod or an iRiver or whatever the product is that moves around with you, even cell phones. On October 12th, Apple released an enhanced iPod that supports video and comes in black, which, of course, is the most important feature. Taylor Barcroft has been a resident of Santa Cruz since the mid-70s. Same with me, actually, Taylor. He's a longtime video journalist of new media trade shows since the early 90s and was among the original desktop publishers in getting on the Macintosh computer in 1984. This summer, he launched a new video blog on new media called futuremedia.org and was immediately recognized as one of the world's best by London's The Independent newspaper. Taylor, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Hi.
So what for you, why do you podcast? Why do you video podcast?
Well, I've been a videographer for so many years without an outlet. And when Apple announced the iTunes 4.8 that was capable of playing video...
Video podcasts, meaning downloading them and then...
Well, no,
them.
It was just capable of playing video. There weren't any to the best of my knowledge, there weren't any video podcasts at that point because iTunes wasn't even an RSS client until 4.9, which was January 28th, rather June 28th, Steve Jobs announced that the 4.9 iTunes would become an RSS client, which means a multimedia client that could allow people to subscribe to audio, video, and PDF feeds from RSS, which means really simple syndication.
Which is what we called podcasting, is really creating an RSS aggregation of the content you're providing.
Right. Up until the 28th of June, the only RSS clients were obscure and had to be discovered by people in very strange locations.
Right.
And then when iTunes became a client, all of a sudden Apple added the podcast directory to the iTunes music store.
And now it's just as simple as looking up stuff on your computer.
Right. You just go to the podcast directory and you can search for all kinds of different podcasts. There's up to about 22,000 podcasts now and several hundred video podcasts among those thousands. And
you saw your outlet for your video work.
Right, exactly. And you can even manually subscribe to RSS feeds that are not listed in the podcast directory, as long as they're iTunes compatible.
Right. I recall when iTunes came out with that, Apple came out with that podcast, we already had a podcast link on our site. It was hard to find. It was only in Meta Information. We weren't publishing it, mostly because of bandwidth issues. GeekSpeak's an hour long. MP3 files of GeekSpeak are actually kind of large. We encode them really rough so that they're kind of lower rate, if you will, though I'm working on getting the higher rate ones up. In any case, what I ran into right away is, oh my gosh, I'm not ready for the mass adoption of podcasting from users that don't go through those complicated steps but just can click a button and launch. So I decided not to submit my own, you know, the GeekSpeak podcast URL to iTunes. A week later, somebody tells me it's up there. I'm like, what? And I found out that the use of subscribing or even manually subscribing to a podcast through iTunes automatically, or did at a time, automatically submitted it to the podcast library at iTunes. So iTunes library gets automatically enhanced. And that's why they have so many. It's kind of like a search engine, if you will.
Well, so you're saying that if you manually subscribe to a feed, it then goes into the directory's listing?
I believe so, because no one here, none of the geeks, for example, submitted us, and we became in the listings. So I had to do a lot to get ready for the kind of traffic we have. And I've had, I think, 130,000 downloads since March of this year of the show, so it's obviously working. A lot of those are
Well, I thought
iTunes.
That Apple had gone out and sought
Maybe they
feeds
did. Maybe they searched
manually.
For feeds. It's very possible.
Because as far as I know, they manually screen every submitted feed before it goes up into the directory.
Well, maybe they look at the ones that have been automatically added manually and assess them. I'm not sure.
Maybe that's true, because I did that before I got listed. But my submission, from submission to listing, was only a week.
Yeah, yeah. That's about when it happened. It launched, and about a week later we were up. So I don't. Maybe they were looking at other search engines. In any case, it's become kind of an easy way for people to get content non-live, to kind of collect content that they want to collect. And because the iTunes interface and the searching capabilities, you have a lot of content. And content's such a dry word for what we're talking about. We're talking about music and talk and, you know, a lot of things that you hear on radio.
Right, but plus there's video and also PDF. PDF can be an enclosure, what we call enclosures, in any post. And that can also be automatically downloaded to a subscriber, uploaded to a subscriber.
Right. And a great
so
thing
I'm using
about
all three.
A great thing about a PDF as well is that you're talking about more traditionally, traditional articles, if you will. Not this idea that it's a web thing per se, but you can do this in a Word document, make a PDF, and have people be able to read exactly the way you format it. Kind of like a
Well, I'm using it for magazine. Links. I'm using it to provide links that the subscriber would not. If I'm assuming my subscriber is not coming to my website,
right?
So if I put a PDF up there with links to back to the website as well as to other websites with video, for example, that I can't host myself. Like, for example, it's Apple's video of the iTunes video iPod announcement. I can't host that. And so I put a PDF with a link to that and links to other things, including the Time magazine cover story of Steve Jobs and so forth up there. And that PDF is rich with, I don't know, 10 or 20 links in there. I think it's more like 20 links. I've got all kinds of links to different Apple pages about different aspects of the video iPod as well as the new G5. And that thing was only 108K, so it came down to the subscribers in a flash.
Right.
And they got, like, tremendous content, 5 pages of details with all kinds of links.
Nice.
And that, yeah, I like that just as much as video, because I was able to link to videos that I can't host.
So some of the videos I saw on futuremedia.org, which is the site you're using for your video blog and PDF blog, were television shows on news segments on large, big boy television shows. So how are you getting the rights, if you will, to share that, or are you just...
We don't have the rights to those, but the we're so small, and the whole video podcasting and video blogging community is so... And it's such an early stage that the hosting companies don't mind hosting those segments, because we're not just putting them up there willy-nilly just for only looking at them,
right,
but to analyze them, because they all have their defective reports. I put them up there specifically to criticize the way the networks are reporting on the video iPod.
One of the stories I saw earlier this week from you, maybe yesterday or before, was in a story, speaking of criticizing someone, of a woman on national television talking about don't buy the iPod yet.
Bambi Francisco.
What a great name.
CBS Market Watch. Yeah, well, talk about an alias.
From San Francisco?
Yeah, she's based in San Francisco. That's likely, right?
It could be. It could be just her name. But
she says she knows there's an enhanced version coming in January. And don't spend your bucks now. Save your bucks till January.
Interesting.
Really insane. It doesn't make any sense. This video iPod has 50% more space than the previous model. It's a 30 gigabyte. Audio.
The base level audio
just for
iPod
audio
was 20, and now it's
It was $2.99 for 20. Now it's 30, and it's lighter and smaller and thinner with a bigger screen than ever before.
And still the same price.
Same price.
So even if you don't think about watching video on your
it's
iPod,
a total
it's a
bonus.
Great new feature.
Yeah, the video is just complete gravy.
The 40 gig didn't increase in price, but it did get lighter and smaller, kind of thing.
No 40 anymore. It's 60.
60.
30 and 60. Yeah, they didn't increase the size, but the screen is bigger, and it's thinner and lighter than ever before. So it's a much better deal, even without the video. And
right,
the video plays fantastically. Plus, they talk about only watching the video on the 2.5-inch screen, which,
everybody,
by the way, looks fabulous.
Yeah,
but there's video output.
Yeah.
And when you put it on a television with the video output, it automatically interpolates up to fill the screen. It's not a little tiny 2.5-inch
right
image on the TV. It's full, screen image.
I think the content is 340 pixels wide. In normal television, we think of 640.
It's 320 by 240, but they double that when they go to a TV output.
Right.
And it fills up the screen completely.
Screen.
It looks great.
And that's the thing, is it's built in, has composite out. So you can plug it in. Or is it S-Video out? I can't recall.
It's composite out. There's S-Video from a dock.
Uh-huh.
You can buy a dock that's got an S-Video port on it.
I've been doing a lot of video work at work recently. And yesterday I finally decided to look up S-Video and composite video and some other formats of video on Wikipedia. Because, of course, it's a great encyclopedia. And finally realized what really it is. S-Video is separated video. Composite video is both your color and your levels are on the same, is encoded.
Chrominance and luminance are in the same
right
channel.
Right, and S-Video is two
separate
channels.
So really, for a layperson, you can hardly see the difference.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
It really depends on the screen.
So that's a good point, because every news segment I've heard about the video iPods, everybody's like, well, you want to watch a video on this little screen?
Plus, the audio is fantastic.
Okay.
You're getting stereo audio that will even go into surround sound if you put it through an analog surround decoder.
All right.
So, that makes a huge difference right there in terms of your impression of the small 2.5 image.
Right.
If you're listening to that stereo, that's the majority of the information.
Sure. Sean?
Can you put your own video on the iPod?
Absolutely. You can encode your own videos to be iPod compatible very easily with
Is it MPEG 2?
QuickTime 7. No, it's MPEG 4.
Oh, okay.
And variations of that, including H.264, which is the new QuickTime 7 encoding system that enhances the quality of the video even
more. So you can take a video that you already own on your computer and push that to your iPod? It doesn't have
you'll
to
need,
from iTunes?
Yeah, as long as it depends on if you already have it in MPEG 4 format.
Yeah, or you'll have
to
convert it.
But it's pretty easy. If you can get it to DVD with a Mac, you can use a thing called Handbrake to rip it back into MPEG-4, okay. And it looks really fantastic.
You know, it's funny. I've been watching video on my iRiver for a long time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And do you encode your own content for that?
I do, yeah.
Does it have a video out to support television?
No.
No, so it's just a small screen thing.
Yeah.
But it's great for traveling and such.
Yeah.
You're listening to Geek Speak, The Geeks This Morning, Sean Cleveland, and our guest, Taylor Barcroft. We're talking about media, future media. His site is futuremedia.org. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
This week in This American Life.
I didn't expect violence from the coalition to have dominated the causes of death.
The scientist who did the most comprehensive survey of how many Iraqi civilians have died.
And no way, reading the New York Times and listening to National Public Radio, would I have believed that the coalition killed far, far, far more people than did the insurgents setting off car bombs.
A study that's been mostly ignored this week.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
You're listening to KUSP. This is Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet, visit geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us.
The Monterey Bay Aquarium is looking for an official explorer to help promote Oceans 2006, a year of exploring. If you're between the ages of 10 and 13 and are committed to conservation, you might be the person they're looking for. For a full list of requirements, benefits, and an application, visit MontereyBayAquarium.org.
Natural Selection Furniture has provided a grant in support of this program. Natural Selection Furniture is open Tuesdays through Sunday at 607 Soquel Avenue between Ocean Street and Branch of 40 in Santa Cruz and online at NaturalSelectionFurniture.com. This is Geek Speak. We're talking about the future of media. We're talking about podcasting. We have guest Taylor Barcroft in, and he and the geeks are waiting for your calls and questions. Of course, you can do that online at geekspeak.org, and you can do that via phone at 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We can handle any kind of calls today. We can handle support calls for your problems with your computer. We love doing that. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. Sean Cleveland is here with us. He's a hardware expert on the Windows platform and many other things. And Taylor Barcroft is our guest. Futurist, interested in media, and knows a lot about podcasting, videocasting, and the future of media. So give us a call if you'd like to ask us questions or comments on any topic.
I'm also a Macintosh expert.
A Mac expert. So we got a Windows expert, a Mac expert.
I'm a Mac consultant, so if anybody needs help.
Okay, so you're the kind of person. Wow, okay, that's a big tall order. So we're going to do
free
a lot of
first hour of consulting.
Nice, very good. 476-2800. Get the consultant needs now, 1-800-655-5877, free to all that call.
Anybody Taylor, can email me at info@futuremedia.org also for that.
Okay, and you'll provide a great list of links to kind of
Yeah, I've got a list
it.
Of links and some intro information to podcasting and video podcasting.
Apple did a big thing when it released the newest iTunes, not the newest, but for iTunes. They released on a Windows environment, too. So they
Yeah, that's a good point to make is that iTunes is not Mac-specific.
Right.
It's a Windows thing as well. So when we're talking about video podcasting, audio podcasting with iTunes, we're not talking about a Mac-specific thing at all. We're talking about Windows. Anybody that's got a Windows computer can download iTunes and QuickTime 7 and have the whole thing working just like it does on a Mac, exactly the same interface.
You can click on podcasts on the left-hand navigation and then type in GeekSpeak and listen to any of the history of our shows. I think we have over 150 shows up. Sean, you've been listening to video and music on your MP3 player. When you travel and you commute over the hill, you listen to books, audiobooks. What do you use as your? Have you ever loaded iTunes? You ever used it?
No.
Have you looked at the interface and stuff?
Oh, we gotta get you going into iTunes.
No.
Do you have QuickTime 7 on there?
I don't. Yeah, I might have QuickTime 7 because it's old QuickTimes.
Well, you had
to.
You
okay, so scroll up to that other the top of that futuremedia.org. Yeah, click on that. And that should launch your Windows Media, your
so Sean
iTunes player.
Sean is currently looking at Barcroft's, Taylor's
So yeah, I've got an iRiver H340. I got the iRiver because I wanted.
There you go. Yeah, see? Works perfectly.
I knew it would.
I'm glad it does.
But, yeah, because with Korean firmware, you can make it run video, which I did. Although it stepped on my digital rights management.
Mm-hmm.
But since I don't use any of that.
It's okay.
I didn't care.
All right. We have calls flowing in. Oh, I think we just lost Eric. Eric, go ahead and call back. Drew from Felton. Small versus large what, Drew?
I just want to kind of hear a comment on, it seems like media, in terms of video, is going two different ways. One is bigger and bigger, bigger screens for home, and then yet portable is smaller and smaller and smaller. And I'm kind of, what's up with that? And do they think there's a real market for watching, you know, length video on a 1-inch by 1-inch screen or 2-inch by 2-inch screen? Because I'm getting trained on my home set to really appreciate huge, big, you know, 50-inch video.
Okay.
Well, I have a 1920 by 1080i high-definition display, and there's no conflict between that and the video iPod. It's a 2.5-inch 320 by 240 display that if you plug in a composite connector with, you know, one of those three-prong connectors that goes yellow, red, blue, white into a TV, it'll blow it up. It'll interpolate up to your set and fill the screen with a very acceptable-looking image, better than VHS. I mean, really good quality. It's going to be a little soft, of course, but it's not significantly soft.
We've said, actually, there's been the way televisions work, you kind of think of them as a 640-wide screen. That's one way of looking at it, even though it's doing technology differently, if you will.
Right.
And taking a 340 and using software to increase the picture, if you will, basically blending.
Well, I've even interpolated up 6X to the high-definition res of something that I had compressed to 320 widescreen of a major motion picture from a DVD with Handbrake, and it still is acceptable. You know, if you understand that the original is 320, it's obviously going to look soft, but the sound is just as good as to begin with.
Right.
And that's the main part of the information is the sound, no matter what the image is.
Images is just a hint, right?
The image is like, it's helpful.
That's why radio is so great. I figure your own imagery, and
we just help. The image is probably no more than 30%, usually less than 30% of the information.
Which processor does the iPod use?
It's got its own. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's got its own.
And it seems to handle action movies okay?
Oh, yeah. Sure, it plays anything really well.
It's not slow? Or
No. It's designed to play 30 frames a second of MPEG-4.
Okay.
And when we encode video for it ourselves, we're only using 10 or 15 frames a second. We're not wasting the bandwidth with 30 frames a second.
Drew, did we answer your question about
that? Yeah, there wasn't really a question. I just wanted to kind of discussion on that whole big versus small.
Yeah.
It just seems to go in two different ways.
Well, the idea of the iPod is the portability, to carry video around from place to place. And like I said before, it still looks totally acceptable when it's blown up on a big screen.
We're basically talking about a portable device that people have been carrying around, MP3 player, that now you can download a show or encode your own stuff and go over to a friend's house and plug it into their TV and watch.
Plus, it takes up really small amounts of space.
Yeah.
Right, and plug it into their TV, I guess, is the part that I was missing. So you can plug those things into a TV.
Totally.
Just a regular RCA cord.
Exactly. It's one of those three-pronged eighths inch, you know, where the third level is video.
It's just
the other end is RCA.
Yellow, red, and white.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Just like a Sony camcorder or any camcorder.
There's even an S-Video dock for the iPod.
If you want to do a higher quality.
If you really think that makes a difference. I, myself, can't see the difference.
All right, Drew, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks, Beth.
That video is so small, you wouldn't.
No, even when it's blown up on a set, it's hard to tell the difference between the two.
You really only see the difference when you're taking really high-end video and putting it on a TV instead of a small video.
Yeah. That's right, because of the interpolation, exactly.
That's a powerful feature.
From Santa Cruz, Blaze, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Hey, I have a quick question about QuickTime. I'd like to upgrade. I have a Mac, and I'd like to upgrade to the latest version. But I actually did that, and I didn't like it because I like to do things like freeze frame and slow motion that was available in the, I think, 6.5 version or whatever the last prior version was.
Right.
But I understand that, and I'm also running into that I can't play certain video content without having the new version for iTunes or
iTunes 6 is a QuickTime 7 required, but there is slow motion and so forth in 7. There's a controller in there that you haven't found in 7.
For non-purchase?
Yeah, if you email me at info@futuremedia.org, I'll send you the links to more detail about that.
Yeah, there's. I just wasn't sure.
Info info@futuremedia.org.
Okay.
Blaise, I'll actually have the links up also on GeekSpeak's site later today. The idea being here that the only thing I was curious about is that QuickTime is a free download and also an upgrade pro version. I'm sure, Taylor, that you have the pro and I have the pro.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm not certain that that interface is there for the non-pro version.
Yeah, that,
a lot of features disabled.
I did notice that too. And if the option is to maybe use a different media player,
sure.
Maybe you would have a suggestion for
yeah,
that.
Sure,
and then also, how would I set the default so when I have a web page and it's going to play something, how would I do that?
I don't know about plugins for your browser for things other than QuickTime. I wouldn't do that on a Macintosh. But you can open QuickTime films in things called like Video LAN Player, VLC, and there's also a couple other ones. But they actually use the QuickTime codec in the background. It's the same. It just has different features to it. And, in fact, all the QuickTime playing capabilities of the Apple is built into the operating system so anybody can use it as a development package. So you'll see other tools out there. The thing is, QuickTime's so good. The pausing stuff, what you can do is copy that to your local machine and then open that in something like VLC. And you can actually open a remote QuickTime file through VLC. And VLC is a great tool.
I love
yeah,
VLC.
Yeah, it's not so convenient when you want to just kind of
no,
see a quick thing that's on a web page.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well,
and
yeah,
then,
I have, in fact,
both versions of QuickTime. Like,
no.
So I could point it to the old one when I want to do that. And
no, in fact, all of my posts are automatically launching the QuickTime player, even if it's 6 or 7, because I decided that it was more important for me, for my subscribers, to have total control over that video. And by opening it in a separate application, they can decide what size they want it to be, and they can move it off to the side of the browser.
Right.
And I don't like the idea of playing in the browser. It just doesn't appeal to me.
The only other version you could have on your machine, if you were running Classic, you could actually have a Classic or an OS 9 version of QuickTime. But then we were talking about an older version that might not play all the content you're
seeing. No, I never even open Classic and don't want to.
I know what you mean, Blaise.
That won't work with the podcast.
No, it won't. Thank you very much, Blaise.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And from Santa Cruz, Eric is back. Hi, Eric, and we will get to Judith in just a moment. If you're interested in calling us and asking us questions about technology, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And of course, Sean is checking our email, and we'll get your email if you go to geekspeak.org. Eric, welcome back to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Hey, I was just wondering, I know they're probably too small capacity, but could you comment on the myriad types of flash players?
Flash drive,
flash drive
players.
Like, they're supposed to be advantageous because, of course, if you're doing active
right
thing, then they won't skip. And
yeah, that's the thing, is these bigger video and audio devices that are portable have hard drives in them. And what you're talking about is things that have solid state called flash
right,
drives.
Right, right. Yeah, I know.
The nano is solid state.
Yeah. Are you interested in getting one?
Well, yeah, and I'm just wondering if you have any comments on even
the iPod Shuffle and the iPod Nano are both flash drives.
Right,
they're half a gig, and 2 and 4 gig, but they don't do video. They don't. You can do photos with the Nano, but only on the screen of the Nano. There's no external video output on the Nano. You've got to go to a regular iPod to even have video out for photos, much less video.
But if you're looking at just for an MP3 drive, is that what you're
looking
for?
Exactly. So that's my question. I understand. I understand the difference between flash memory and hard drives.
Right. Okay. So,
but there's a myriad. Wait. I'm just wanting to say, it's not just the Apple iPods, but there's a myriad of other brands.
Sure.
And each brand has like 10 different offerings. So I was wondering if you had any sort of general comments on...
Apple's the only way to go.
I'll have a more general comment than that, Eric. Flash drives, for portable content, I think it's a great solution. The only issue, really, is running out of space. But when you think of, like, a 3-gig device, because you can get them now, 4 gigs even, I think you can even get a larger...
2 and 4 is what the Nanos are.
The Nanos, sure, but in other markets you can get other things. Even a 2-gig flash drive, especially if it's got a screen and you can navigate it and actually figure out where you're playing, if you care about that kind of thing, would be fine for like 7 hours of audio play. It's even more than that, I think.
So
the question would be really the transfer speed. That's what you want to really focus on, is because you're going to theoretically run out of space and you might not have your entire library on this device. That's another thing. I know a lot of people that have large libraries, they want the entire library all the time. What you have to do instead is kind of manage your library a little bit. But most devices will allow you to make playlists and then copy the playlist to the device. And in the Mac environment, it's really simple. If you're not in a Mac environment...
But I'm not a Mac guy.
Sure.
So So, and do you really think the iPod's so superior to, you know, iRiver?
No. Well, iPod is not just a Mac thing. It's just as much as a Windows thing as it is a Mac thing.
But,
so there's no problem with
basically. What I'm saying is, why should I get an iPod rather than, which doesn't have an FM tuner, rather than
a River or something?
Creative, iRiver, SanDisk, you know, a million other ones which tend to be less expensive and you know, have some more.
I think the only reason you'd want to do that is that in that Apple environment, you've got a full package. You've got iTunes and one of those pods. Then you've got a really simple way to, like, make a randomized playlist or copy all these songs over or at night do this. But there's always offerings on the other platforms that do the same type of things. I'm not personally aware of them. Sean, what about your thing?
The iRiver H340 has an FM tuner.
Mm-hmm.
And
a flash drive.
I tried using it once.
Oh, right.
No, it's a mechanical hard drive.
The one you have.
40 gig. I tried using it. And tell you the truth, the reception's terrible. It relies on a special headphone as the antenna, and other ones don't work as well, and I don't want to use the little earbuds because they hurt my ears. So, yeah, just be aware of that. If you're buying one of these for an FM tuner, go try it first, because you may not be happy with the quality.
Of reception. So I think a flash drive makes a lot of sense, and you can find great solutions. Winamp on the Windows environment allows you to do this kind of work, and it's pretty easy. The other thing is, you don't have
that again. What did you say?
Winamp is a good player on the Windows environment. Of course, iTunes is a good player on the Windows environment. I don't know if it would work with non-Apple flash drives. The thing is, you're going to be managing your content a little bit. That's all. So you're going to have a connected drive up. You're going to see it as a hard drive. You erase the MP3 files off of it. You move new MP3 files from your computer onto it. It's going to take a little while to do it, and then your device is ready. I mean, it's really that simple. But that is, you know, that's some steps.
So you're saying just the reason to go with iPod is it's easier to manage.
Well, it takes away some of the technology for your, you know, you don't have to deal with as much technology. Uh-huh. Eric, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to go one more. Judith's been waiting a long time from Wattsmill. Judith, hi.
Hi. Yeah. I have a more general question. It's specifically about Macintosh. I have a iBook G4, and there's an address book program on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a V card from the address book.
Yeah.
And then, I tried doing that, and I thought, well, I should be able to import that to some other database program, but the only other database program that I'm aware of is in the AppleWork 6, and I couldn't figure out how to do that, and I didn't know whether is what can you import that to, or what is that used for?
Well, V cards, you can, Outlook Express can take them. Outlook can take them, so you can attach them to your signature, and then the person that's receiving your email can decide to add you to their address book. I believe Eudora supports them. But when you're talking about another database, are you talking about a local thing, like a FileMaker thing? What exactly are you looking to do, Judith?
Well, I basically to transfer the data into a different format to be able to use it and print it up in different ways, rather than just the standard way that address book prints it up if you print it.
Well, there are a lot of options in printing with address book. If you've got the current version, it's there's a huge number of options about how that prints out.
So you could do that. You get into that
print dialog box of address book, you'll see that it's not one way.
But let's say you want to get your entire address book in an Excel document because you're going to do a mass mailing and you want to do mail merge with Word or something like that. There's tools to do that. They're not built into Apple, but doing Google searches will get those to you. I've looked at things that plugins to FileMaker that allow you to manage the data through FileMaker. I've seen a thing called... I can't recall. iReports, I think. It's an external application that allows you to format again. I don't know if you can save that data to an Excel document or a tab-limited document, but it definitely does that features for you. I would do some searching on it because it's going to be a specific thing you're trying to do. But make sure you understand what your target is so that you can really try to find out how to do that. A tab-limited format is a very universal format.
Email me and I'll try and figure it out for you.
info@futuremedia.org. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Sean, we have an email?
We do. Joe from Santa Cruz asks, how do I download to my photo iPod images from either my hard drive or from a CD?
Well, you simply open up the iPod and launch iPhoto, and there's an interface between the two.
So using iPhoto, you load your images, and then you'll see your iPod, photo-supported iPod, in iPhoto, and you just drag them over.
Right.
Okay.
Pretty good. assuming
I'm sure a lot of people, you know, they don't understand how these things work.
Yeah, of course.
It's quite a lot of money to invest.
How do you,
you
do
know?
It? Yeah.
And I don't, yeah. Does Apple do a good job of showing?
Yeah, the details are on their website. There's discussion boards as well as other sites. Just email me if you still can't figure it out, and I'll help you with the links to those pages.
Taylor, what about on a Windows environment? If you happen to use an iPod Photo, can you get images onto
it? Yeah, there's also a way for that off of Windows, but
you're not sure how to do that.
I'm not familiar with that, The details are in the documentation that comes with the iPod.
iPod, so you have some information in that
iPod
device.
Photo, right?
All right. And the iPod Photo, not the Nano.
Well,
iPod
since a year ago, October 04 was when they launched the iPod that is capable of displaying photos.
And of course, you got to also remember that any of the iPod Photos have had ability to show that on a television screen as well.
Exactly. So they've video out since a year ago.
All right. Nice. We have Robert from Santa Cruz on line 5. Robert, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. My question is, I work on Macs, and in terms of moving files from computer to computer, I've used flash drives, like thumb drives, and also zip disks and CDs and stuff like that. And I'm just getting an external hard drive to be able to do that. And I wanted to know what's different about using external hard drives for moving files around from computer to computer. And also, if I did want to go to a PC occasionally, what would I encounter there?
Well, it doesn't matter if you're on a Mac or PC. Moving data with an external hard drive is kind of inherently dangerous because mechanical hard drive is inside those enclosures, and they're not meant to be bumped around. That being said, I do it. But
it's dangerous. The firmware
enclosure?
Yeah, it does both firmware and USB 2.
You need to get 32-bit format?
FAT32,
is that what
you use? Yeah, I use NTFS. On a Macintosh, you probably want to use FAT32. I don't have a Macintosh, so I don't have that problem. But, you know, I don't keep data on that drive that's important to me. Or if I do, not very long, I try and copy it over to a computer as soon as I can. It's more of a place for data to reside while I'm out and about. But I don't know if I would trust it as a backup source unless it was just it sat on my desk and never moved.
Yeah, but Sean, I mean, everybody carries these portable devices around. We have students at UCSC that in the production crew of video, and we're talking about hundreds of students, and they all have to have their FireWire drive with them. They carry it in their backpack. And yes, you have failures, but it is a very convenient.
Drop that from 3 to 5 feet.
Don't drop it.
Yeah, they are fragile. If you have a power failure, we had a power failure a few weeks ago, and I lost an external that way.
Uh huh. Yeah, they're fragile.
And you know, on a Macintosh, but on a Windows system, you can't just unplug the drive when you're done. You really need to unmount it first. Yeah, that's very important.
Definitely.
On a Macintosh environment, you take that drive icon and you throw it in your trash can, and on a Windows environment, on the bottom right hand.
In the task pane.
And then you turn power off before you unplug it.
Right?
Yeah.
And on the bottom right hand corner on a Windows machine, you right click click a thing that looks, it's kind of has a green and gray symbol, and if you hover it over, it'll say deactivate.
You know, I do have a. One recommendation, don't get a desktop hard drive. The larger ones, get the smaller ones with a notebook hard drive in it, because notebook hard drives are made to be
moved around.
And a lot of those don't require an external power supply. They're powered directly off the FireWire or USB cable.
They're a little more expensive.
Very convenient, and they have sizes of 40 to 60 gigs now.
The only thing about those smaller portable hard drives is that they look like they're more easy to throw around.
Yeah.
You've got to be careful about that. You've got to think about the cost every time you pick it up, and think about the data on there. It's important, because if you treat it rough, it'll die quicker.
I use a lot of externals with 3.5s inside of them. Uh-huh. I've got a whole bunch of cases in there, because the drives are so large, I can have a 250 or a 400 inside
there.
That's
nice. Definitely. And for video work, it's crucial.
One of the things I'm wondering about is the computer recognizing, does the computer automatically recognize it as a drive? Do I need any worry about drivers or anything?
Newer machines, you're not going to have to worry about drivers at all. It's plug and play.
Yeah, you'll just need to format the hard drive, and once you've done that, you should see it as another drive letter.
And in fact, with the hard drive, the ones you buy normally are already ready for you with FAT32 that will work on both platforms. So you're ready to go once you get one.
Okay, and if I do go to OS 9.
OS 9?
OS 9 is going to be a problem.
You really should get off of that if you can.
But if you go to OS 9, you're going to want USB support more than FireWire.
As long as your computer has USB ports, you can have Panther on there, 10.3. And if it has a FireWire port, it can be Tiger, the current operating system.
But Robert's saying if he has his data which on his machine, he goes to somebody that has an OS 9, how does he connect it?
If you have the latest drivers, the 9.2.2, it will work.
Yeah. But normally OS 9 computers don't have FireWire ports. So. The later ones do. But
As long as there's a FireWire port and it's 9.2.2, the drivers are there.
Yeah.
You've got to have it. It's got to go to 9.2.2 to have the drivers to see the FireWire driver.
Thank you, Robert, for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, we've got one more call from Boulder Creek. Fred, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, this is Fred from Boulder Creek. Hi, geeks.
Hi,
Fred.
I've been wanting to get a digital audio tape recorder. These are called DAT recorders, you know, to take into the field with me and do oral interviews and record nature sounds.
Uh-huh.
And they're pretty expensive. And I'm wondering, can this new iPod serve in that way? In other words, could you hook up a microphone to it and take it into the field and get pretty good audio recording?
Yes, you can. There are two audio record modes for speech and higher fidelity music and outdoor sounds and stuff. And you have to have a certain adapter from a third-party manufacturer to be able to plug in an external microphone to get the microphone away from the iPod so you don't get noise from the hard drive.
Now,
and those are still coming because they changed where the port is on the newest iPod. So it depends on which one you get. If you get the new one with the video capability, you may have to wait a few more months for the
input
the compatible microphone input device from either Belkin or Griffin.
Now, Fred, I know a gentleman that travels a lot, and he does have an iPod Photo, one of the earlier ones that came out, and he had a Belkin input device for recording, and then the microphone built into it was mono, but the jack supposedly was a stereo jack, and he had a lot of trouble trying to get a stereo recording from it. The newer versions, I believe, have stereo support.
Yeah, there's two audio recording settings built into the operating system of the newest iPod.
So there you go. You're just going to have to wait a little bit on the microphone.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Fred.
Should be out by Macworld Expo in January at the latest.
Okay, I'll hold off then.
Thank you, Fred.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, that's actually an extended geek, Fred, McPherson, who is our biology geek, if you will, and is currently looking at some of the products that we looked at during our Digital Photography Month on organizing photos. We're going to be doing more of that in the upcoming months. We're getting Apple on to talk about their newest thing, Aperture, which is a photo management tool, and also Adobe Photoshop Elements 4 came out. I took a cursory look at it last night, and the thing I'm impressed about the most is that it has almost all the features of Photoshop that I would need to work on photographs, including RAW support. So Photoshop Elements 4 recently came out by Adobe. We're going to have the product manager on in 2 weeks, and we're going to talk about maybe you don't need to buy Photoshop to deal with photos, but that's a big maybe. So we'll see if that really holds true. We're talking with Taylor Barcroft. The entire hour we've been talking with Taylor, except for the geek news that kind of went long. Sorry about that. And Taylor's site is futuremedia.org. You can reach him for questions and comments after the show ends at info@futuremedia.org, and that's an email address if you're curious. We'll have a whole bunch of links from him later on today on our site, geekspeak.org. And, of course, we do podcast, as does Taylor. Let me ask you one last question. What's the most liberating thing about video podcasting?
Well, from a publisher's point of view, it's free. We have a free hosting site. We have a way to reach millions of people for almost no cost. And so it's revolutionary in terms of being able... It's really a marketing problem,
getting people to know that
you're there.
Is there a cost for the user to watch it?
No, it's all... The subscriptions are so far free, although there will be a pay model coming.
Yeah. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton, offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, DHL, and more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com. Thank you all for being on GeekSpeak today. Taylor.
Thank you.
And Sean, you can learn more about Taylor Barcroft's work at futuremedia.org. And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. And to those that called in, thanks for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. Who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kusp.org. Coming up next is The Open Road, and then later, Two Steps to the Blues with Charlie Lang. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell.